Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and the editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, the newly vaccinated Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Daniel, are you here with us?
Yes. Do I look like someone who's been fully vaccinated? Can you tell?
Uh-huh. You definitely sound like a fully vaccinated person.
I have
person.
That vaccinated glow. I guess. I don't know.
And that now makes two of us. So we are making progress here. All right. So Endeavor made history this week. The talent agency turned conglomerate of all kinds of things, including sports, launched an initial public offering on the New York Stock Exchange at a $10 billion valuation, becoming the first such company to become a public one. And by such company, I mean very hard to define what Endeavor is. But at the center of it all is Ari Emanuel, the brash and extremely ambitious CEO. So we're going to dig into this with The Wrap's senior business reporters, Diane Haithman and Tim Basinger, who took a deep dive to look at Ari Emanuel and the IPO this week.
Then the Oscar ratings were in the toilet. We all knew they would be. And so were all awards shows this year. So what does that say about the future of awards shows? We're going to break it down with The Wrap's TV editor, Tony Maglio. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. So as you know, the Oscars were Sunday night, and they were pretty snubs and surprise free for about 3 hours. That is until Anthony Hopkins won the Best Actor award and not Chadwick Boseman. Otherwise, the show went pretty much according to script. Nomadland won Best Picture, Chloe Zhao took home Best Director, and Frances McDormand won Best Actress. The Oscars mark the end of award season, which this year was very long and very strange. Sharon, what did you think of this year's Academy Awards, and how will you remember this award season?
Well, leaving the telecast aside, I think it was a pretty remarkable year. Yes, it was really long, like 2 months longer than usual. And yes, it was weird because of COVID. But this is a year when finally we had an enormous amount of diversity among both the nominees and among the winners. And I think that despite, yes, the telecast had crap ratings, yes, it was not particularly well produced or thought through, but you know, you had Chloe Zhao win, the first Asian woman ever win Best Director. She also won Best Picture. You had Frances McDormand winning two more Oscars, Best Actress and Best Picture, because she's a producer on Nomadland. You had an all-Black producing team on Judas and the Black Messiah. You had what most people thought was going to be a posthumous award for another amazing Black performance in Chadwick Boseman, and he didn't win. But still, the fact that that would even be considered, because it is extremely unusual for the Oscars to give a posthumous award, was just something else. And there was a lot of discussion about that. The hair and makeup team that won for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, you know, the winner spoke very eloquently about diversity and how it felt to have greater, just a broader range of kinds of people and different ethnicities, more gender equity, LGBTQ people involved. And I think seeing that happen is something that is going to stay. And I very much hope that it will become not a one-off, but a trend. So that is what will stay with me.
Yeah, I found myself feeling bad for Anthony Hopkins. He didn't get a chance to, they wouldn't let him Zoom in for the awards because he didn't want to travel to London for it. And because we were all expecting Chadwick Boseman to win, it was like, it was just such an anticlimactic moment. And he sort of like gave an online speech the next day. But you talk to anyone who really watched the movies, and it wasn't that much of a surprise that he won, or at least he was certainly very deserving. It was a very great performance. He was fantastic in that movie.
Yeah, it was a great performance.
But I feel bad that award will always kind of be remembered as the one that he won when we all thought Chadwick would win.
I think he's very, very thrilled in his 80s to be getting an Academy Award. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. He seems like a pretty happy guy. I follow him on Twitter.
He's a very fun guy.
Yeah.
It was just very, the whole show. I mean, and you mentioned it a little bit, you know, they took this huge gamble of not closing with Best Picture, moving it up a little bit, which was really fun to watch on Twitter because we in the media knew that they'd changed the order. But as the award show started to go on, people on Twitter were like, wait a minute, why is Best Picture happening now? And they sort of realized what was happening. And it seems the producers bet on having this fantastic moment at the end with Chadwick, and it just didn't happen. And the award show just ended so abruptly. It just was a bad moment all around, I think.
Yeah, it definitely was. But live and learn. Okay, so live from New York, it's Elon Musk. It was announced this week that the eccentric Tesla CEO would host Saturday Night Live on May 8th with Miley Cyrus as musical guest. So Musk has his fans for sure, but he also has many, many detractors, not the least of which include a couple of SNL cast members, A.D. Bryant and Bowen Yang, who voiced their displeasure on social media before they deleted their posts. So, you know, Elon Musk spread COVID-19 misinformation during the early days of the pandemic, and he has ranted against media outlets that have run investigative pieces about Tesla. But he has also built the most valuable car company in the world, which also will not destroy the planet. So, Daniel, do you have issues with Elon Musk hosting SNL?
I love whenever they announce hosts. I have friends that whenever they release new names, I text them, I'm like, three new hosts, and we have guests. I try and make them guests. There's something about the SNL host to me that still means something. And I don't particularly care about Elon. I don't know if I'll watch it, but I think it's totally fine. Do you know who the last non-actor or athlete to host SNL was?
Oh my God, you're going to quiz me on SNL?
I'm going to quiz you live.
That seems really unfair. No, I don't.
It's really easy if you think about it. It was Donald Trump.
Oh.
He was the last non-actor or actress to host. It's not something that happens too often. I remember Steve Forbes hosted once back in the day. Gore has hosted. McCain has hosted.
Listen, it's
a CEO, though. That's a weird pick.
No, it's not. Elon Musk is the most...
I don't think there's ever been a CEO of a company that's hosted.
He moves the stock market with a single tweet. He has now single-handedly helped Ari Emanuel successfully IPO by joining the board of Endeavor. I mean, he's marketing catnip. And just look at how much we're talking about SNL because they're having Elon Musk host. So it really doesn't friggin' matter if he's a terrible host or a deserving host. It's a brilliant marketing move. And by the way, I mean, Elon Musk is legit nutty. Okay. But I don't think he's dangerous. You know, his COVID remarks were completely friggin' stupid, but he was hardly one of the most damaging voices out there, number one. I just think that people feel like Elon Musk already has everything. Do we have to give him SNL too? I think that's kind of what's going on. And so that being the case, I would just say, yeah, it's probably not cool. You out there, you probably would do just as good a job hosting SNL as Elon Musk will, but you would not be the marketing bonanza for NBC as that Elon Musk is. So just, I would say, get over it.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I think people will be rooting for him to do poorly, which I think would be just as funny as if he does well. I don't know. We'll see what happens. It's going to be, maybe I will tune in. I'm starting to talk myself into it a little bit.
All right, I'm just going to catch the clips. I never stay up
late. Yeah, I'll send you
past my bedtime.
All right. Conservative media is under fire this week for a couple of stories that turned out to not really be stories about the Biden administration. A New York Post reporter quit after she claimed she was ordered to write a story about Kamala Harris's book being given out to migrant children as part of their welcome kit, which turned out to be completely false. It was one book. And a Fox anchor admitted on air that Biden had not, in fact, said he was going to restrict hamburgers or other meat. I cannot believe that people actually thought that was a thing. You know, I was reminded of the famous expression that I think came from Mark Twain, a lie can travel around the world and back again while the truth is lacing up its boots. Sharon, it was a weird week for conservative media. What do you think is going on?
I think they are just desperate and grasping.
Anything to bash Biden and Harris, right?
They cannot get a beat on this guy. Joe Biden is just nice. He's reasonable. He doesn't yell. He says things like, come on, man, we just got to pull these folks together. And he's just like, he's unbelievably folksy. If you watched the his address to the Joint Houses of Congress, and you could see, I watched a little bit of Sean Hannity afterwards. I just thought he can't get a hook in him, you know. And he started, they splutter and they splutter. So I think that's where they've been sliding into essentially invented stories that must have started somewhere as a smidgen of something, but they look ridiculous. And of course, we're coming out of 4 years of, you know, becoming accustomed to hearing lies come from the White House and then repeating them on air. So they need to get out of that habit, but it really looks super pathetic. What's your point?
Yeah, I agree. I think to your point, today Ted Cruz tweeted about Joe Biden not tweeting enough. Like, that's what we're going to complain about now. Like, that's a thing.
You mean Ted Cruz, the guy who fell asleep during the joint?
Not enough. The joint session. You know, Snooze Cruz. What a Ted Snooze. I saw a few different good ones there.
Yep.
He lends himself well.
Yeah, he doesn't tweet enough. And I think the problem with Biden not tweeting, first of all, it's insane to me, like, how Joe Biden, how disciplined he's being about his messaging and how sort of, you know, ambitious he's being. But in any event, the conservative media is going to have to work harder. The idea that the conservative, I mean, and what they're also reflecting is the lack of an agenda, the lack of cohesion, and the lack of a vision in the conservative party and the conservative movement. So they don't have a lot to draw on from there. So something interesting and maybe not good, you know, we've already had not good, but, you know, I'm a big believer in having a two-party system and don't feel it's healthy to have a conservative party that's in such disarray that has allowed itself to be corrupted so deeply by the Trump troop that they just, and have went so far out on a limb during those 4 years that they really have nowhere to go now except to continue driving into voter suppression and policies that don't appeal to a broad swath of America, or a broad enough swath of America, I should say, to win elections. I don't think that's healthy at all. Right now, the Democratic Party, to me, again, not a political reporter, but an observer and a citizen and a taxpayer, thank you very much. You know, I feel like the Democratic Party is doing the things that the American public wants it to do. And there was a very, very interesting poll after Biden's speech on CNN that had some upwards of 64% approval of Biden's speech overall and his ideas, and something like 70%, 75% for a lot of the policies that he was laying out in that speech. Those were people who had listened to the speech, not the general population, but people who had listened. And it's astonishing at how many people are drawn to what Biden is saying and wanting to do, because they are quite progressive. And the conservative movement needs to get its act together and come up with a new approach. And I do think that the conservative media is kind of lost without having that kind of grounding.
Grasping at straws is what comes to mind. Yeah, they're just...
Oh, well, you said it better there, yeah.
They're just trying to find something that isn't there and doing it in a foolish way. Really? Going to ban beef? Come on. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and maybe something that has a little more riled up, a little angry maybe even, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Well, I'm just going to continue to wax on what I was just waxing on before, which is the success thus far of the Biden administration. That's my wax on. I mean, Joe Biden gave an address to both houses of Congress, a joint address this week, and it was incredibly low key. I was watching some of the conservative commentators on Twitter and such during the speech. They're saying he's so boring or falling asleep, but I didn't find it boring at all. It was just not bombastic, not hysterical, not full of slogans. It was full of substance. It was full of substantive policy proposals that he is very likely to try and do, whether it is the infrastructure bill, whether it is getting everybody vaccinated, which he's already well on his way to accomplishing, whether it is extending the, you know, updating the healthcare, Obamacare, whether it is reaching out to the trans community, which he did in a way that was very, a beautiful, brief and very beautiful moment that I'm sure is very meaningful in a community that is too often ignored by government. So I thought that it was so impressive. It has been impressive to see him perform with such clarity of purpose and decisiveness and lack of bombast, and very much bring you back to the idea of what it means to serve the public, the idea of service in government, is what he, it feels like it's what he's all about. And I'm not so cynical that I won't say that it's something that is deeply needed in this country, a reminder of that, an example of that in our highest office, and can make, can create so much good in the ripple effect that it has in this country and around the world. It is the role that America has traditionally played at its best. And I think Biden wants to fill that role. And I have to say, I'm very much admiring of what he's doing right now. That's my wax on. My wax off is back to our Oscar discussion. Very sad that the very deserving and a dear friend, Diane Warren, 12 times nominated for Best Song, yet again went home empty-handed. Diane being Diane, took it in stride. She said, well, it was good to be nominated all over her social feed. Of course, her who won Best Song and gave an amazing performance, because I tuned in before the Oscars to watch the performances, which were very cool, you know, was really deserving. But man, Diane's got to win one of these years.
All right, crazy. Daniel. She's never won.
Yeah, totally crazy. Anyway, how about you?
Yeah, I just want to tell a quick story that's a kind of a wax on. I'm looking back at it now. And December 6th, I got the text message that every person in L.A. kind of hates getting. And that's, do you want to see my movie? Right? Anyone who's got a friend who works in the business, it's like, oh, God, now I have to watch this thing. And I just said, yes, sure. And the friend sent it to me and I watched it and I thought it was great. And on Sunday, Two Distant Strangers won the best short film Oscar. It is so crazy that it just went from like a random, I mean, look, amazing. I'm not the only person who saw this. It was, you know.
It was a producer who sent it to you? A friend
His name, my friend of mine named Van Lathan. It was Trayvon Free who wrote and directed it.
Right.
And it's on Netflix now. So I just want to recommend it for people who have not had a chance to see it. It's called Two Distant Strangers.
And we had it twice. We had it twice in our short contenders panel before the nominations. And then we had it as part of our Oscar nominee showcase after the nominations. And it's a really cool film because they like pulled it together in no time.
Yeah. Shot during COVID. It was fantastic. It's just so incredible to see. Like, again, I just feel like it was one of those moments for me where I was like, my friend just won an Oscar. It was
That's
pretty great.
Cool.
Yeah, very I was cool. very, very happy for him. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll dig into Endeavor's IPO and what it means for its CEO, Ari Emanuel. And we'll talk about what this year's low Oscar ratings mean for the future of awards shows. Stay tuned.
If at first you don't succeed, IPO again. Ari Emanuel and Endeavor went public on Thursday morning, and if it hasn't lit the world on fire, it is, so far, so good. But many question why the hot-tempered, longtime Asian has had such huge ambitions, taking on almost $6 billion in debt for a whole series of acquisitions, and now launching an IPO after a first attempt in 2019 fizzled. So here to talk about this juicy topic are our Wrap Pro team, Diane Haithman and Tim Basinger, who just wrote a terrific piece about Ari Emanuel in this week's edition of Wrap Pro. Diane and Tim, tell us what you think about what you learned in this piece of reportage about why Ari Emanuel has been driven to do the second IPO after the first one failed.
Well, I think Ari, the he's probably a guy that I would imagine ever since it failed in 2019, he was probably chomping at the bit to do it, to try to do it right and do it again, because he doesn't want that stain on his resume. Like, that was a huge black mark that he took a whooping in the press after it didn't work the first time. Mm. So I think as soon as it didn't work, I can imagine the next day he probably had the guys huddled and was like, okay, when are we going to do this? Because this has to be right when we do it the second time.
Yeah, except that that Endeavor's financial performance has gone only further downward since COVID, right? Like, all of their representation stopped because there's no movies being made, and live entertainment, a huge part of their balance sheet, has gone away. And, you know, your stories have, I think, said that they've lost like over $1 billion in the past 2 years.
$1.2 billion loss at the past, yeah, in 20 and 19.
So isn't it risky?
Oh, it's incredibly risky, but they're banking on them being the comeback story with live events coming back because people are getting vaccinated, and, you know, the progress at least the U.S. is going better than maybe some people thought it would at the beginning of the year. So there is that comeback story that they're trying to ride. And when I spoke to Endeavor president Mark Shapiro earlier today, shortly after trading opened, that was his big kind of reasoning for why they did it right now. They said the investor community was kind of giving them the signal that this was a good time to do it. They got Elon Musk on board, which they're really excited about. And
on the board.
On the board. They didn't think he'd do it because he doesn't sit on really any other boards of companies. So they were shocked that he even wanted to do it. But they're banking on the fact that stadiums are opening up for sports. Live events are, at some point this year, probably going to be coming back more and more.
You know, we're talking about something, even though we say he's an agent, we're talking about a company that's much more than Hollywood, as you're bringing up. It's all about sports. It's all about, we've seen how sports are coming back faster than other things. You know, there's just so much financial pressure to get people out there on fields and, you know, performing, that I think he's kind of banking on that. And again, maybe just interested in expanding, exploring the field. He's very involved in fashion. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of elements to this person that aren't really communicated by kind of his history as an agent, I think.
I mean, the UFC was the first one that held a completely 100% capacity indoor sporting event last weekend in Jacksonville. They had 15,000 fans at UFC 261. And I'm not surprised that the UFC was the first one to do that.
Well, part of the story that was really interesting that you guys wrote this week talks about Ari's personality and he has this very tempestuous reputation. Of course, he was the model for Ari Gold on Entourage, which you guys point out, which is really funny. And that people kind of mirror that in their reaction to him, in the sense of he's not evil, you know, in a way like people think of Scott Rudin, but he's a force and can be nasty, right? I don't know. Diane, what's your take?
Yeah. I mean, my take on it again is, you know, we're in a sort of different era than we were when Entourage came out, but, you know, but that there's some things that we've all come to accept as somewhat lovable about these neurotic, crazy, out there kind of personalities. And whether that's going to work for him in 2021, we don't know. But I think everybody has this sense that they know him, not only from the TV show, but if you're at all connected with Hollywood, oh yeah, Ari Emanuel, and everybody's got an opinion. You say, yeah, do you know him? Have you ever met him? Oh no, but here's what I think of him. Seems to be the way it goes, is that he's got a bit of a legendary quality. And that's rare now, you know, with executives. I don't think people really have any stories to tell about Bob Iger, but they do have stories to tell about Ari Emanuel. So, you know, I think that that's...
Ari Emanuel has stories to tell about Bob Iger. He kind of gave the guy hit him with a 2x4 in that article profile of the New Yorker.
That's true. But that was his point, right? That, you know, nobody's going to remember that type of executive. They're going to remember me, I think was the implication.
And do you think that's true? I mean, I'm not sure I agree that people won't remember Bob Iger. I mean, certainly they'll remember Steve Jobs, which is part of the other half of the quote.
Yeah.
Do you guys agree with that?
Go ahead, Tim, because you... I think so. What the thing that I was getting the impression is that, and one of the things that has made Elon Musk so interesting, is that the personalities, the big players, are now in tech. You're still allowed to be a nutcase in tech, but that what the hedge fund investors are looking for from Hollywood executives is more of a Bob Iger, more of I can rely on this person. He's going to behave himself. There aren't going to be any surprises. Here's somebody who can dig into traditional IP and make it work and reinvent it and all those things. And that Ari's wild cardness is, we don't know how that's going to play out this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get what he was saying with Bob Iger. I just think Bob Iger was the wrong example. Like, he was saying, like, a top media executive, like, okay, and say, like, Bob Backish or somebody.
Yeah, that's actually true.
That might make more sense.
You know, but I think Bob Iger is kind of, because Bob Iger is rare for media executives, and that he has this sort of outsized, I won't say personality, but kind of his outsized importance to the industry, and the fact that he is probably one of the few media CEOs, well, I guess not former CEOs, that the non-person in our field would probably know of.
And also because his accomplishments at Disney, mm-hmm. not that we're talking about Disney, but were freaking monumental, quite honestly.
He started Disney at a bad time when they weren't doing so well.
Yeah, and he did, and you know, just like Ari, he dates back to an era when, you know, we in our article we talk about, someone had referred to Ari as one of the last gunslingers, that in a different style, so is Bob Iger. You know, he flew by the seat of his pants. He came along before data analytics were telling us what everybody wanted and what everybody needed and what would succeed on Netflix. So, you know, they have some things in common in that way.
Well, I think there's a fine line between being passionate and just being a jerk. And I feel like it seems like Ari straddles that very, very well.
How does Elon Musk actually fit into this? I'm not sure. It seems like such a weird thing, because Ari Emanuel does not seem like the kind of guy to me who wants to cede any of the spotlight. Well, I just think of, like, if you're Ari Emanuel, right, he wants to be the star. That's the feeling I get from him. And now you bring in Elon Musk, who's the star in every room he walks into. I don't know how that's going to play out. Do you guys have any idea how that's going to work?
Well, Mark this morning told me, you know, like I said earlier, like they didn't think he'd do it, and because he said you mesh those two personalities together, and I think Elon was more like a business play. They know that he is the head of a public company. He knows the investor crowd, especially the Robinhood investors and the retail investors.
Yeah,
and they're looking to tap into that, and they think he's their bridge to that.
Yeah, at some point at 60, it seems that you do have to say, who am I going to bring along? Who am I going to have join me? You can't really say I'm going to be the only star in the room forever. And maybe that some of that is on his mind, is what's the next, how do I bring in the next generation? And again, somebody who has a nod to this much more digital world that we're in than when he began.
So how has the IPO been going on day one? We're doing this on day one.
It opened, you know, they priced it at $24 a share. I think it opened actually a little higher than that, closer to 27, and then it's finished at around 25. So, if for lack of a better word, it's been fine, which I think for them is good. Because the worst thing that could have happened is that it could have cratered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it didn't. But it's also, you know, day one's important. It's what we write about because it's the first chance we get to see how the investor crowd is looking at it.
Yeah.
But to be very cliche, it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. There's plenty of companies that did not do well in their IPO. Facebook had a lackluster IPO.
In the beginning.
Yes, on their IPO day, it was pretty lackluster. Mm-hmm. Peloton 2019, which is one of the reasons Endeavor pulled out, is their IPO was lackluster. Now they're doing great. So it's, you know, Snapchat had a great IPO their first day. Then they fell down because people thought they were priced too high. And now they're back up because they're doing so well. So it's it is a roller coaster, and you kind of have to just not pay attention to every day, every quarter. You have to look at it, the long game. I mean, Mark today said, I'm going to try not to obsess over our stock price. I told my agents not to obsess over it.
He's the president of the company, Mark Shapiro, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, ask me how we're doing in 2 years, and that's what I want to be measured by.
Well, this is the question. You know, one of the sort of learnings from the first failed IPO was that, or at least one of the things that was said, hard to say exactly whether it's true or not, is that investors didn't understand what Endeavor was. What were they buying exactly?
Yeah.
So do you think that they've answered that question? Do you think people know what Endeavor is? And I'll just tell you that critics, agents, people even who were responding to me on Twitter today were taking the piss out of it, saying it's just this cobbled together group of companies that don't provide any synergies to one another, there's no long-term business plan necessarily around how these companies mesh together and create greater value for the shareholder. I just put that question, like, what is Endeavor ultimately?
Well, I think that was definitely their problem in 2019, is that no one really knew what they were buying, and they should have just said, hey, you're buying into the UFC. Now that one is now they're going to own all of it, which helps. And I think when they put out their filing this time, when they registered, I think they did a little better job of breaking out their three distinct business parts: the representation part, the live events part, and their sports properties. Mm. So it helped it a little bit in terms of, like, here's where our money is coming from and here's what that's looking like, which I think made it a little easier for people to digest. You know, because I wrote this 2 years ago when the first one failed, was that, you know, if you're buying AT&T stock, you're buying Disney stock, you know exactly what you're buying. Endeavor, you really weren't sure, am I buying the talent? Am I buying the UFC? Like, it didn't really know. Right. I think it did a little better job of that. And one of Mark's things he told me was that because they're in so many different businesses, even if they don't appear to be aligned, you know, that some people, he's like, because we're in so many, that's what makes us great, because we touch all these different things.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
but they're not, but it's true.
So it's hard to fit in that little headline when people say, but what is it? You know, there's a lot there, and that's.
Mark was a salesman this morning. I'll give him that.
Yeah, and he is good at that, and obviously obviously Ari is as well. One of the things that I also found really interesting in the coverage you guys have been doing is to think about how big of a hit talent representation took in terms of what it contributes to the bottom line of the company, and or the top line, however you want to look at it, and whether that's going to come back, because obviously during COVID it was bad, but also you've got this issue of the WGA doing away with packaging fees for Endeavor. Isn't that going to hurt?
Yeah, it'll come back from what it did in 2020, because in 2018 and 2019, it was like a really close second to their live events business in terms of revenue.
And do you know how much it was offhand?
I want to say it was something like in 2019, I think it was something like the live events was like 1.8 billion and the representation was like 1.6 billion. It was like that close.
Oh, okay.
And then it went to like 900 million in 2020. It lost 700 million because of COVID. And, you know, so they'll get some of that back because, you know, productions are kind of back and everything. But yeah, the packaging fee part of it, they're making a lot of money on that. And so we don't know how much of the lost revenue they'll be able to make back. It's on.
Right. And it's certainly on his record, just like the failed IPO, that you lost the battle with WGA. And that's just something people have in their heads as a line that needs to be overcome. Yeah.
Well, because they were the agency that were pushing so hard on packaging fees?
I mean, they're certainly not the only one who lost, but yes, they were pushing very hard and they didn't get their way.
Yeah, I think WGA clearly won on that against all the big four.
Yeah.
Right.
But WME, I think, was the last one that, like, crossed the line.
They were. I think that they were the last ones to be persuaded. The last, yeah. But again, it just looks like, you know, it's a question. It's one of those things that going into it, people are asking themselves, which may be why we're seeing so much push about sports, about those other things.
Well, yeah, they own, but now they're going to have to. But the funny thing about being a public company is you have to report earnings. We're going to have to see their books every single quarter. Ari's going to have to be on those conference calls with analysts, needling them on everything every single quarter. So it's, how is he going to deal with that? Where that's different than wooing some client to come to your agency.
Right.
Yeah, it's very different. It's very different. Unless he wants to put a CFO on the line instead of him. I don't know who their CFO is.
But I mean, it'll be interesting to see if he does feel that he needs to reinvent his image in some way to match this new move, or whether it's just, I can do it. This is who I am. Here I go. You know, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Go ahead, Daniel.
No, I was just going to say, one last question. Tim, you mentioned, Mark Shapiro said, judge us 2 years from now. Do you have any predictions about 2 years from now?
I'm gonna like, it's probably a lame prediction, but like again, I think they'll be like fine. I don't think it's gonna be, they're gonna have this crazy run, but I don't know if they're gonna have this crazy dip either. Cause the one thing they do have is live events. Yes, they will come back. The UFC is extremely popular and it's extremely popular on digital with a younger fan base, and they're gonna own all of it. So I think they'll do fine. I think how much debt they're gonna keep taking on, or whether or not they're gonna reduce some of that, is going to, I think, answer that question.
Diane?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, honestly. I mean, I think I'm like everybody else that I don't know. I would seem again that yes, just as Tim was saying, that they're into some areas that have already begun to show that, you know, we can beat the pandemic. You know, we can go on after it, and we can revive quickly. It's probably a good thing they're not that involved in live theater. I mean, there are some things I think that are going to be slower, but when we talk live events, you're talking about outdoor, big, you know, the kind of things that we can count on people being involved in. And I, like I said before, I think in terms of just Ari the person, that's, you know, remains to be seen whether he changes his legend, whether maybe you can't, maybe he'll always be Ari Gold, you know, in people's minds. I mean, it may be that's just one of those things that, you know, particularly people outside of Hollywood will, that's where it stopped for them. But I don't know. I think, you know, they've got as big a chance as anybody. That's kind of how I look at it.
It's hard to predict because no one's ever done this. And that's that makes it.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think you got to give him credit for that. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you did do it.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, Tim, Diane, thank you very much for joining us, helping us understand all of this. You know, Tim and Diane write for Wrap Pro, which is a members-only offering from The Wrap and an essential news source for the entertainment business. Wrap Pro is designed specifically for Hollywood insiders who want to stay on top of the business of movies, TV, and streaming, and includes exclusive access, news, and insights that are not available anywhere else. For more information and to join Wrap Pro now, visit thewrap.com/join. Sunday night's Oscars were the lowest rated of all time, and it was not even close. But they were far from the only awards show to suffer a pandemic nosedive. Are awards shows no longer the big draw they once were? Or will the ratings return when normal life does? Joining us to discuss is The Wrap's TV editor and ratings czar, Tony Maglio. How's it going, Tony?
Oh, I like czar.
Good. I like ratings czar. Yeah, I'll join you more often with that.
Yeah, we'll add that to your Twitter profile.
Because I would have gone like guru, but I like czar.
I'll take what I could get.
Yeah. More authoritative. All right, Tony, let's get the numbers out of the way. Break it down for us. Just how bad were these Oscar ratings?
Yeah, they're absolutely terrible. I mean, in terms of total viewers, they luckily topped 10 million, which is even lower than, you know, I would have thought. I would have thought, you know, just under 12 or something. But, you know, not only was the show, frankly, set up to fail, given COVID, given no movies in theaters, given no hosts, given a whole, you know, a whole host of issues that I had to contend with. It was a boring show, in my opinion. I don't think I'm the only one with that opinion. And so when you have a boring show that lasts 3+ hours, even though it was fairly brief as far as an Oscars is concerned, you still have to average those ratings over 3 hours. So anybody who goes to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, 10:30 at night, or not even asleep, just switches off for something else, you're cutting that panelist, that Nielsen panelist out and dragging that rating down. And another weird decision, I don't know if we were going to get to this as a question, but a weird decision was to not even have Best Picture last. And I understand why, the prevailing theory being that if Chadwick Boseman won Best Actor, it would be a really nice, touching, emotional moment to go out on. Turns out he didn't. Anthony Hopkins wasn't even there. They didn't let him zoom in his speech. So it just ended with a dud. It was just a totally weird show, and the ratings were horrible, and they kind of deserved each other.
Go ahead. Well, the other thing I would say is, like, what's interesting when you stand back and you look at the award shows is that there is certainly a consensus around what you just described as, like, it was not a good show. They shoved all the fun performances into a pre-show, didn't tell anybody or promote that particularly, all the best songs, and then decided not to show clips from the movies, because why entertain people with actual clips from the movies when you could actually read them descriptions of such. But the other award shows that tried other things didn't do much better. And that to me is like the most interesting trend that's going on. It's like they're all down about 2/3, right?
No, that's totally fair to say. I'm not trying to pick on the Oscars. They're just the biggest and the latest. The Golden Globes plummeted even worse. The Grammys, terrible. The Emmys hold up because the Emmys have such a low starting point to begin with. They put on a better show, but they have a low starting point to begin with. They're so, I wouldn't even say late in the season because they're not in award season. They're in like September.
Right.
So they didn't have nearly as far to fall. They don't have nearly as much hype. They don't have nearly as much expectation or advertising dollars or any of these things behind them. So you're 100% right to say that pretty much everything, almost everything, has been a failure in COVID season, especially in terms of awards. But yeah, the Oscars, we just hold them to a very high standard, and for good reason. They're the most prestigious. They're the highest rated. They get the biggest bucks, and it was just a dud. And they had all this extra time to plan for it. And I don't really know why what the finished product that we saw, why that was the plan. I thought some things were cool. I thought the opening was cool. But after that, I'm with you. I did not understand a lot of the camera work and reading fun factoids about these nominees, especially some of them that we don't even know, the below the line or behind the scenes, I should say, nominees. Mm-hmm. So it was there were a lot of strange decisions, in my opinion. But yes, you're of course right. The biggest problem is COVID. The biggest problem is theatrical closing. The biggest problem is, you know, just general ratings.
Well, is it COVID? Is it COVID? I mean, award shows are down, you know, over a decade. And what are you going to do about it? Like, now they had the biggest drop, but they've been going down. So
yeah, yes, well, of course. What I was going to finish saying there was rating trends are a problem, right? They go down, basically everything but football continues to go down and down and down and down. Right. So declines and record lows were inevitable. No doubt about that. But 60% losses, 55% losses is insane. So the only thing I can attribute that is to COVID. And in terms of the Oscars specifically, one big difference between the Oscars and the Emmys and the Golden Globes are in between because they're both TV and film. We still got good TV shows and we still experienced them in the way that we would experience TV shows. Mm-hmm. Some were delayed because of COVID production issues, but I haven't been in a theater in a year and a half and it's just not the same. And, you know, if you don't have Amazon Prime, you're not going to sign up for it just because they have two or three buzzy movies. You might over time, and in Amazon's Prime, in the case of Amazon Prime, there's a whole lot of things that you get out of that. But, you know, everyone has Netflix, not everyone has HBO, certainly not everyone has Amazon or Peacock. And so it really depends what platform you're on. And none of them are in the theaters. So there's just the buzz wasn't there. I don't know if I even saw a Best Picture nominee this year. It's a weird year. I know, which is bad, but at least I'm a TV guy. So,
so Tony, to your point, I've been clamoring for weeks and months that the Oscars needed a host. And something was brought up to me when I was listening to a different podcast this week. Did you realize that Frances McDormand became only the third actor ever to win three or more Best Actress or Actor trophies? Like, she set a huge record and we didn't have a host or anyone to sort of point it out. I felt like the Oscars were missing something that let us know what was going on.
Hold up. The host of the Oscars never would point out on the show that
there would have been
something. No, there is a little voice like this. This is Glenn Close's third Oscar or whatever. Like that's what they do. They do it like that. But it wasn't Glenn Close. It was, of course, Frances McDormand. She took home two Oscars. So she now has four Oscars and she's tied with two other Oscar historic winners. And that they never would say that on the show. They're way too elegant.
Yeah, I just felt like the show lacked any sense of what was actually going on. And I feel like, you know, and I'll ask you both this question really, but I feel like we're going to completely forget this Oscars in a couple of years, or at least the movies from it. It's just not even going to be like a thing.
Sharon, I'll defer to you on that one.
It's not. You guys keep wanting to talk about this Oscar show, which I totally understand, but I keep wanting to talk about the fact that award shows in general are on a downward slide, and COVID, like all the other trends that it accelerated, just accelerated this one by a lot. And so the question has been for a number of years, what are the award shows going to do? And the question that used to be with like, A, delayed viewing, B, streaming competition, C, YouTube and TikTok and Clubhouse and all the other things you can do with your time. We've been seeing those numbers go down. And so those questions about what do you do about these serious declines going forward, because we've tried it with a host, we've tried it without a host, we've tried it with music, we've tried it without music, we've tried it all different kinds of ways, and now we've said the Grammys did it live, the Golden Globes did it like in a little, everybody's in a box, you know, so it feels like these just are getting smaller overall, and that there isn't a way to bring them back. Like Daniel, if they brought Billy Crystal circa 1990 back, okay, it wouldn't really help. And that may not be your solution, but, you know.
I do love Billy, but yeah.
There's one solution. Yeah, sure. The one solution is lower your expectations. I mean, because you're not wrong. It's right. A host will boost it. Non-COVID will boost it. Better movies will boost it. A funny monologue, good song and dance numbers, something fun like the Emmys did with the hazmat suits. That'll boost it, but like we're talking like a little bit, like 5%, 10% maybe, and it will level off again and it'll start declining again. Right. Because that's just the nature of TV. It's certainly the nature of broadcast TV in the streaming era. You just have to lower your expectations. And I know one of the, you know, things near and dear to your heart, Sharon, is if you lower your expectations, shouldn't you be lowering your advertising dollars?
Yeah, well, it's like just seems logical.
Yeah. And so that is something that over time we'll probably see erode and we'll probably see happen. But yeah, the lowered expectations is the only thing you can do. The only reason, I don't want to go off on a tangent about ad dollars, but it's still all relative, right? So basically everything but football, and even in some cases in football, I mean, the Super Bowl will do not get good ratings this year, but you know, no crowd or a lesser crowd and you know, bad lead up and all that stuff didn't help. But yeah, everything is relative. So, you know, 35 million viewers is 27 million viewers or whatever the Oscars could have gotten, you know, in the last couple of years.
Right.
But yeah, we're not going to have a boost where we get back to 34 million viewers for the Oscars. It's just not going to happen. And again, yeah. I don't want to just focus on the Oscars. Like you said, I'm talking Golden Globes. I'm talking Emmys to a much, much smaller number. But yet, I don't think there's any sort of magic fix. How are you going to get people to broadcast TV?
Why aren't the Emmys more better watched? Why isn't it a more entertaining telecast?
My opinion is it's at a weird time. It's not an award season. You know, out in LA, you never stop seeing the billboards, right? But here I am in New Jersey currently, and I'm on the East Coast, and we don't get any of that stuff out there. So I think it's very easy when you're in LA to be hyper aware of when things are, but for the rest of the country, I don't think that's the case. And, you know, Nielsen measures the entirety of the country. Middle America too counts, you know, on Nielsen panels. So I think not being an award season doesn't help at all. It's certainly just never had the cachet of the Academy Awards. I mean, it was never close, but yeah, I don't really have an answer why it gets 6 and 7 million viewers instead of 11 and 12. That baffles me a little bit too, because the Golden Globes should not, they do have movies, but they don't carry the weight that the Emmys do. So I really don't have an answer for you on that other than timing and cachet.
Yeah. I wonder if they moved it to say the middle of the year instead of September, if it might be, because you can really set that cycle whenever you want to. It doesn't have to be in September. There used to be a season, but there isn't really a TV season anymore.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So the cutoff dates are somewhat arbitrary and could be changed. I don't know. I mean, what I've said for years about the Oscars is that the show is excruciatingly long and there's all of this stuff that is so boring that gets shoved into the show because the Board of Governors, as if Steve Pond were here, I will now channel him and tell you that the Board of Governors is a highly politicized organization that doesn't allow, you know, like everybody wants their, you know, segment on the telecast. So whether it's the in memoriam or whether it's the sound editors, it's like, well, if you take out the sound editors, then, then the sound mixers have to do the same or whatever. It's like, nobody wants you to touch the show, and things like hair and makeup, sound editing, sound mixing, you know, special effects, the humanitarian award, unless it's somebody's famous. I mean, I went on and on about the ridiculous motion picture television fund, 5 minutes, nobody in America knew or cared about this, like the home for the aged for Hollywood, like get it out of the show. Like if it were an hour and a half show, I'd feel like, and really tightly written and had performances, I feel like it could do better. I'm not saying like 35 million better, but I think it could do a lot better. But that's a political problem inside the Academy.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's just simple mathematics. You have fewer minutes to average your number. If it's a high number, will stay higher. And there's a reason why 8 o'clock shows are higher rated and 9 o'clock shows are higher rated and 10 o'clock shows right. are basically just delayed viewing, basically just DVR numbers. So time slots matter. I totally agree with you. I don't know if they could do 90 minutes because of all the things you just said, but yeah, having an entertaining, fun show helps too. I mean, you know, not to make a value judgment one way or the other, but you know, a lot of people in America don't want the entire show to be, I shouldn't say the entire show, but a good portion of the show to be preaching politics, whether they agree or disagree. And so when you are focused on
Yeah, this was kind of doing, yeah, that's, that also I thought like rang.
You're just kneecapping yourself because it's a show that's supposed to entertain and it's celebrating entertainment. And entertainment is taking a backseat in many segments or in some segments to political speeches or statements. And that's all great, but it's not great for TV ratings, especially if half the country doesn't agree with you.
You can't prevent the winners from saying what they want to say. But you don't have to write it into the script of the show.
Right, exactly. And it's probably inevitable. And that's, you know, it's fine. And people who agree with the messages are fine with it, but you know, you got half the country that doesn't, and you know, they don't, you know, there's people that claim they don't watch football because of the kneeling. I don't believe that for a second, but I do believe that there are people who don't watch the Oscars because of the politics. So, you know, that's another thing, but
you think there are people who don't watch because they think they're Hollywood libtards?
I think so. I think they get tired of the message over and over again. Obviously mostly people who don't agree with the message. If you agree with the message, I think it's perfectly fine for us, but yeah, I do believe that's the case. But in terms of football, I don't think anybody actually, I think that's just something people.
I'd love to see some market research on that. And I bet ABC is doing it.
Mm. Yeah, it's tough. You know, how are you going to extract it? You can't extract it from the speeches, as you said, and I wouldn't encourage them to try to censor anybody. That would be received very poorly. But yeah, listen, it's supposed to be one of the most entertaining shows of the year. You brought up Billy Crystal and the heyday of the Oscars. You know, I was young then. I don't remember it, but all the stories I hear, that was, you know, pretty much pure entertainment. And that's what people used to tune in to these shows for, escapism and entertainment and celebrating entertainment. And that's not necessarily the case. Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe that this year people aren't in a celebrating kind of mood. Like after the last year that we've had, do you really care who wins an Oscar? Like we've gone through a lot more important things in this last year. I think maybe that had something to do with it.
I think the one thing I'll say about, the Oscars and the hostless thing, and I know I touched on it before, it was a novelty when they lost a host. I don't know if that was the Kevin Hart year first or Kevin Hart was the second year they went hostless. I don't
think it was that
recall
year.
Off the top of my head. There was a novelty and we were like, oh, what are they going to do without a host? Because hosting the Oscars is such a thing. It's like hosting SNL might be, or I mean, on a much bigger scale because SNL is like 30 episodes a year, but it's a big, big ordeal. It's a big deal. And now without a host, it's not only rudderless, it's humorless. You know, I mentioned the politics before and, you know, candidly, I think, you know, I'll just speak for myself. We all agree, I think, with the message of the politics, but to continue it in lieu of entertainment and in lieu of comedy, I don't think
you're talking about like, just to be clear on what you're talking about, I think you're talking about that. The Oscars open with a very somber message about sort of the moment that we're in. And he didn't talk about police brutality, but was nodding to the George Floyd trial. And it was almost like we're not allowed to have a good time talking about movies without acknowledging that we're in a very difficult moment or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's a place for that. I don't know if there's like a 13-minute place for that because that ended up being about as long as a monologue. And then the only attempt at humor, and from as a former comedy writer, I thought it was the bit with DeButt and
I thought it was
lame. It was not funny. And that was the only attempt. It's not like that was the lame comedy bit of the night. That was the comedy bit of the night. So I'm not against the message at all. And I think it's an elephant in the room if you don't acknowledge it. But this is a telecast. It is a telecast meant to entertain people. And you have to remember that. And that's what Jimmy Kimmel had brought to the Oscars.
Right.
And that's what he brought to the Emmys.
Like, one of my favorite moments was, like, I forget who was hosting, when they ordered pizza and they started delivering pizza and they brought the pizza delivery guy up on stage. Because they were trying to make it less snooty and more popular. That was the attempt that year. Then one year, it was the year Ellen, I guess, did the big selfie with everybody. That was also a great piece of marketing for the show to use afterwards, because it became like a lasting image that was memorable and fun. And that was, I think, relatable to people. That, again, I think that's what they were trying to do for a while, which is also why they expanded the Best Picture category to allow more accessible big budget films to qualify for Best Picture. But at least, like, that feels broad and accessible as opposed to, I listen, everybody wailed on the show itself, so I think that's we're not unique in that regard at all, but the show's got to find another tone, and I think another format, and I think the format problem has been around for a really long time, and you know, just because we keep saying it and they keep not doing it doesn't mean that someday they won't listen to us.
Yeah, and get used to sub 20 million viewers. I mean, just get used to it. It's the new normal. I know it's jarring to some people who don't pay close attention to it or who are kind of in and out of it over the last few years, but this is just the new normal. There, you know, other than live sporting events, and even those, you know, depending on the sport, depending on the event, can be down. This is just the new normal. Every day, you know, I write numbers that I can't believe. You know, if I fell asleep 5 years ago, even, which is certainly the DVR era, and woke up now, and certainly Netflix was around then, and so those numbers, I think it's a bomb. It's just a different way of watching.
One final thing also, like one final thought I have on that, which is that if this was the number that they delivered, and granted the films were not seen very widely, and granted they were kind of somber in tone, and Nomadland and, you know, Minari, they're not like a laugh a minute, and they're not West Side Story, which is coming up, and they're not In the Heights, which are fun, big, celebrate. They're not La La Land. But if that's the number they're pulling when people have nowhere else to go and nothing else to do, then what's going to happen next year when people will presumably have the ability to go do other things outside their home? So,
yeah, no, it's a very good thought. And listen, the market, we live in a free market. Capitalism, it'll correct itself. I don't expect you're going to see the millions of dollars for a 30-second ad. Why would you pay for that? You know, the Super Bowl is pretty predictable. The Oscars used to be predictable. Not so much anymore. There's got to be something more that attracts advertisers and that big sort of money to the Oscars if they're getting 10 million viewers, which, again, I don't think they will next year, but I don't think they're going to get 20. So it is a long-term problem, even though we're, you know, it's very glaring at the moment.
All right, Tony, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate you helping us break it all down. You can always check out Tony's ratings column on Rap Pro. I highly recommend it. No one knows ratings better than him. He is, after all, as I said earlier, the czar.
The ratings czar, yes.
Thank you, Tony.
Change that. Thanks, Tony. Make my column that name. Thank you, guys.
Done.
Yeah, coming shortly. And that's going to be it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.